Eat Drink Indiana Radio is brought to you by Eskenazi Health, one of Central Indiana's leading providers of health care. Eat Drink Indiana Radio is powered by EatDrinkIndy.com, where Central Indiana turns to learn about food from farm to fork and drink from grains to glass.
Welcome to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD to the Point. I'm your host, Jolene Ketzenberger. This week on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we are talking about local food businesses, and we're hearing from a variety of enterprising entrepreneurs, including Mel McMahon of Indiana Originals, Kate Drury of the Flying Cupcake and the Dancing Donut, Rita Franco of La Mexi Gringa and the Flippin' Kitchen, Kent Allison of Two Bears Honey, and Aaron Eds of Dark Horse Delicatessen. So stay with us here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, here on WFYI and WFYI.org. Shop local. It's become a catchphrase, but really, that's what we're about here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio and at EatDrinkIndy.com. The website features news and information about local restaurants and bars, special dinners, farmers markets, craft beer, and recipes, too. And you can catch up with everything I'm up to on my blog, where you'll hear plenty about my favorite local foods and restaurants and what I'm up to. But shopping local has become a passion and a business for local radio personality Mel McMahon. You can hear her on Hank FM and High 99 Country, as well as B105.7 and WIBC. But she is also co-owner with her husband Lance of Indiana Originals, a company that aims to connect Hoosiers to local businesses. I caught up with Mel recently and talked about launching her Indiana Originals and what the company hopes to do for local businesses. So, Indiana Originals. Tell me what it is and how it works and how you came up with that idea.
Sure. Indiana Originals is an association of locally owned and operated businesses that were started in Indiana. So lots of people like to buy local and shop local and use local, but there hasn't really been a good way to identify local until now. So Indiana Originals' goal is to become the accreditation of locally owned businesses that were started in Indiana.
Any kind of business? Do you, one category or another, or just anything from Indiana?
It can be any kind of business. It could be services, artisans, restaurants, food products, clothing lines, publications, blogs and news sites, financial institutions, health and wellness, home and garden, shops. I mean, the whole idea is to make local easier to find.
Right. Because that is the challenge sometimes. People might want to shop local or look for a local purveyor of whatever it is they're looking for, but they don't know where to find one maybe.
Exactly. And sometimes what you think is local, if you dig down, really isn't local at all. You know, I can think of, you know, quite a few restaurants. There's just one location in the nearby area. So people think that, oh, well, it's a local restaurant. Turns out that company just puts one location in each region. So you think it's local. And the easier it is to find local, the easier it is to support local and use local. And, you know, Indiana Originals, it's really not, you know, it's not a concept, it's not a movement, it's economics. If you spend your money locally, more of that money stays local. Therefore, it's put back into the local economy, improving the quality of life of not only you and your family, but of also the people that are around you.
So it has the ramifications down the road. It's not just your new curtains or your new sofa or the pour you're going to go on a Friday night. It stretches out throughout the whole community.
Exactly. It's where you pay your taxes. It's the sidewalks. It's the streetlights. It's what your neighborhood looks like. It's taking pride in where you live and working with, you know, meeting your neighbors, meeting the people who own these businesses. It's sponsoring little league teams. I mean, it goes a long way. It really does. And you can really stretch that dollar if you spend it locally.
Now tell me how you created the concept and just what it is that the company does.
The concept, it came from a few things. My husband and I were downtown on Monument Circle here in Indianapolis, and we wanted to go to dinner. We wanted it to be local. We wanted it to be somewhere we had never been. but we didn't even know what was open or where to find something that was local. Because especially in highly populated areas like downtowns, you might have something that looks local, but really isn't. Or something that really is local, but because it's in a strip mall or something, you're not going to recognize that it's local. And so we were just kind of frustrated, like, oh, I wish there was some easy way to find local. And sometime after that, I was going to buy curtains. And I didn't want to go to a big chain store. I wanted to go somewhere local to buy curtains. And I just, I'm racking my brain, where do I go to buy curtains? And just having this conversation with my husband, I'm like, why can't we find local? Why isn't it easy to find local? And he's just like, well, why don't we make it easy? And so I brainstormed with a six-year-old, came up with the name, and the concept kind of built itself from there after talking to business owners and finding out what kind of resources they need, what would help them, and then finding out, okay, as consumers, what do we need?
Well, now, what do you think it brings to the consumer?
For the consumer, it really makes local easier to find. So the focus of Indiana Originals is to really promote our members, make easier local to find, or make local easier to find. That way it's easier to use and easier to support. So it's really building the identification and exposure of who's your own businesses. So we want you to be able to walk down a street and look at, you know, five stores in a strip mall and see one that has the Indiana Originals membership sticker on it. And you're like, oh, that's local. And you prefer to go to that store. We don't have anything against chain stores. We don't have anything against bigger corporations. That's not what Indiana Originals is all about, because they all have their purpose as well. They provide jobs. That's a big one. They provide insight into what the local market needs. They'll tell you what's competitive. You know, what do we need to market for here? But it's just trying to make it easier for consumers. So if you want to, let's say you want to open a bank account. Well, what banks are truly local? Well, you go to IndianaOriginals.com, look under business and finance, and you'll see Financial Center, which is an Indiana started bank with multiple locations. Maybe that'd be the bank for you. I don't know, but at least you can find it.
So then tell me then what businesses get out of it and what it takes to become a member of Indiana Originals.
Yeah, well, I'll actually start with that one. So to enroll as an Indiana Originals member, your business must be started in Indiana. It must be operated in Indiana, headquartered here. It cannot be a franchise unless that franchise was started in Indiana. And you must be registered with the Indiana Secretary of State's office. What you get from the membership depends on the level of membership that you buy. So let's just say you just want to enroll, you want to be a part of it. Mm-hmm. So you get a customized listing on the IndianaOriginals.com website, which is great for businesses that don't have their own website, because they actually get their own profile page. It has their logo, it has a map of where they're located, their business hours, description, they can put coupons on there, they can maximize the potential of that listing. They get a badge to put in their place of business, so a sticker that as soon as consumers walk in, they know they're in a local business. We also have labels that you can put on your products, so people know that they're getting an Indiana-made product. And then you get special invitations to events and opportunities to be in our newsletters and opportunities for growth through our other monthly membership options, which can all be found at IndianaOriginals.com.
Well, now, just tell me a little bit about your background and why this is such a good fit for you.
Well, my background, it's very eclectic. Most of it is in broadcasting. So I've been in radio and television for a long time. And I grew up in Irvington on the east side. And growing up in Irvington, there's a lot of pride there. And you want to go to those local businesses and those restaurants and, you know, the stores, and you want to buy local products, and just kind of that pride is, you know, that's where that comes from, is growing up on the east side. And being in broadcasting, I've worked with a lot of businesses, helping them build, you know, their media campaigns. I have a big marketing background. And so I've worked with a lot of business owners, and over the years just listened, you know, to what their needs are.
So tell me a little bit more about where people can find some information about it and see the examples of what you're talking about.
The easiest place to go is IndianaOriginals.com. That's our website. But we're also on Facebook and Twitter and Pinterest and Google Plus and YouTube and any other place I can think of to put Indiana Originals out there. You know, it's a very grassroots effort, just like a lot of small businesses start out as. And the easiest way to find out more information, too, is you can just contact me. And my email address is Mel, M-E-L, at IndianaOriginals.com.
To find out more about Mel and her company, go to IndianaOriginals.com. When the Flying Cupcake opened in Indianapolis, owner Kate Drury pretty much had the market to herself, which actually made it hard to launch her cupcake shop since bankers just didn't get the business model.
2007 is when I opened the Flying Cupcake. It was summer or fall of 2007.
What were you thinking at the time? What was the hope at the time?
I just hoped like every day I'd have like one sale. I was like, honestly, it's always been my, as an entrepreneur, I had a boutique before that. And that was always my goal. If I could just have the register not say zero at the end of the day, I'd be okay. That was it. So that was really my goal, and it was hard at first because there weren't any cupcakes here. And people would come in to look, which I always think is funny when people come to look in a bakery. That is not me, but they...
So they were browsing, or did they just kind of want to check it out?
Yeah, they just didn't get it. They were like, so you just, your whole thing is just cupcakes? I don't get it. And now, like, here we are, and there's cupcakes. You know, people are almost like, ugh, cupcakes. But at the time, even going to the bank to get a loan, they were just like, I couldn't get a loan.
And as it turned out, it was still tough to convince them when she was ready to expand into donuts. But Drury just knew she had a good concept with the dancing donut. And from the lines that were out the door and around the building the first weekend, it looks like customers agree.
I have been wanting to do a donut shop for 4 years. I still own my boutique, which I haven't had for 2.5 years, when I was in my first negotiation for a donut shop. The deal had fallen through. It was going to be in Broderpool, right in Broderpool, and that was such a negative experience that I just shelved it. And then I just focused on expanding. And once I felt like I'm at a place where I want to be with the cupcakes, then I could revisit this. Now, in the meantime, there have been more that have opened, but I knew it was going to be the next. I mean, again, same thing as I did with the cupcakes. You could see that was coming years ago. So
you really did. So you saw the popularity of donuts coming, you know, while it was still down the road a ways?
Yeah, like 4 or 5 years ago. Donut plant in New York and Voodoo Donut out west. It's very similar. Difference to me is donuts are something that I think they even embrace more of the population for some reason. I mean, I've got plenty of guys that come in and love the Flying Cupcake, but men seem to really love their donuts. So I'm definitely noticing demographically it's more split than, say, your average day if you're just looking out at who's coming in to the Flying Cupcake. But it's great. It just like the cupcakes, it crosses. There is no, people always say, what's your demographic? There isn't. There's no age, no race, no sexual orientation. And secondly, I don't care. Of course, as everybody knows, I could care less. But it just doesn't. It's everybody loves all of these things. So you're making a product really that makes everybody happy. So, and I love that. That's just how I get validation, is making something that makes people happy.
You know, you're looking pretty smart here with the cupcakes and the donuts, right?
You hope so. You can go wrong. I try to take time, and I've been, along with my kitchen manager, developing these recipes for months and months in our Karma location. So we had these locked in before I signed a lease. But these guys come in at 10 p.m. That is when they start, the night before. Start with the dough process, and it's all night long. It's all hand-rolled, hand-cut. It's all scratch. The glazes, everything, the ganache, everything. So it's a lot of prep to do it by 7 a.m. And then at the end of the day, you do it again for the next day. So it is a lot of work. So that part has definitely been a challenge for me to kind of get back into that groove of being in the kitchen as opposed to being out of the kitchen.
How do you go about developing the recipes for that? How long did it take you to come up with the menu?
Well, the menu is, once you get your basics, the menu kind of writes itself. The saying that I believe in, this comes from practicing law, there's just nothing new under the sun. Pinterest is a fabulous resource to find things that maybe you didn't think of putting together. So I do look there, but then just I take feedback from all of our, we have a lot of culinary grads that work for us, their input, and then just once we got the yeast down, we'd put the different things together. We'd make a bunch of different things, fillings, compotes, glazes, icings, like, and mix them up. Okay, let's throw bacon on it. I've got many things up in this brain, but if I add one more thing to this menu right now, I'm going to be in big trouble. So I'm not doing that. I'm going to slowly add because that is what I did with the flying cupcake. It just doesn't seem like it now. I kind of like, all right, I didn't have 50 flavors to start. I had 12.
How many donuts are you going through a day?
Today, from the looks of it, the rain slowed us down a little today, admittedly. But every day we are ending at about, right at about 3 with maybe 2 or 3 donuts left. And we're making between 600 and 700.
That's a lot of donuts.
That's a lot of donuts. Now, we also get an extra 3 or 4 dozen. Well, tomorrow we'll get 6 dozen from Raw, the gluten-free location for the Flying Cupcake. When we say we have gluten-free options, we really do have gluten-free options. And then we also have gluten-free and vegan that we fry here in their own fryers, but they are made on site, so I always caution people about that. But we do offer that because I know that was probably the next question that came up the most is, will you have things like you do at Raw? No, not like completely. That's a totally dedicated location.
Well, now tell me about that a little bit.
That was 2.5 years ago. Illinois Street, when you open other locations, it's not like generally your business just doubles. You are kind of pilfering off of one location because the people were driving. And Illinois, which is my first location and my little special baby, that took a little bit of a hit. And I felt like people were... that had come to that and given me all that business for all those years, when we moved the commissary to Carmel, that was really troubling to them. They were missing that aspect of it. It's an open kitchen as well. So we brought it back, and we bake on site there the gluten-free and vegan options. So there is no gluten or dairy on site there, raw ingredients. We do offer our regular cupcakes there, but they are brought in, and everything is very color-coded and specialized, and boxes are different, and gloves are different, and tongs are different, and they're put in a different case. So that's how that has evolved. In fact, we were just on this vegan roadie show that is an awesome little project that they have a blog and everything, and he had come to Indianapolis, and we were one of the few restaurants that he picked, and my manager over there, Kelly Miles, has been with me, I don't even know how many years now, but she is also vegan. So the people who work there generally either are practice one or the other, both, and so they can really relate to the customer. So if you have questions or concerns, they understand and they can answer them, and they take that very seriously. So that's how it evolved. So in those cupcakes, if you have 2 or 3, some are gluten, some are, you can't tell. You wouldn't know what's not there. That's what I always say, is you don't know what's not in it.
I wonder, that's kind of a nice way to look at it, right?
You don't know what you're missing. You just know it's a good product. It's still all made from scratch, still all hand-mixed and everything. It's just smaller batches without dairy and without animal products or gluten.
Now, are there other things coming down the road? More donut shops somewhere else?
I'm always thinking, and even though it's like when I had my kids, I always thought you need like that downtime before you can think about it again, and I have 3. Yes, I could definitely see adding another donut location, but I won't rush into it. We're going to get this right and listen to, you know, anyone's concerns. Or so far, the feedback has been very positive, so I'm very happy with that. But, you know, you just have to settle in for a little while. Make sure you're really as good as you think you might be, and make sure. And then you have to kind of do your research. Once I commit, though, I, like I said, I'm 0 to 10. Once I make the decision, I'll find that spot in a matter of months, start the build out, and have at it.
We've been talking about the Dancing Donut with owner Kate Drury, also of the Flying Cupcake. For more information, go to theflyingcupcakebakery.com. and thedancingdonut.com, or look for both on Facebook. Eat, Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu. Here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, we cover everything from restaurants and chefs to farmers and food artisans of all sizes, from the newest startups to the most established local companies. And that's the kind of range we're spotlighting in today's show. So first up, we'll be talking with Rita Franco of La Mexigringa Tamale Business, and now of the Flippin' Kitchen, a new shared commercial kitchen space at 6129 East Washington Street.
I stopped by this space recently to find out how Rita came to be making tamales and how she hopes to help other food entrepreneurs at the Flippin' Kitchen.
Tell me first a little bit about how the business started and how you kind of got into making tamales.
So the business name is La Mexi Gringa. And my best friend's from Mexico, and me and her would, for the past 7 years, we would be at home one weekend, and we would just make about 150 tamales and sell them just to kind of to friends and family. We'd usually do it after Christmas to make up for what we spent.
So the business took off?
Yes. Yeah, it did. I accidentally started a business because I really didn't mean to. Just some amazing people in the neighborhood found out about me, and all of a sudden my Facebook page grew from 100 to 600. So then I just decided that it's probably time to walk into starting a business.
So tell me, is this like the inspiration for your business?
So a bill came up that was due that I had not budgeted for when I was, you know, at home with my four kids. And I am an entrepreneur, so I was getting on Facebook and I'm like, I will prep your food, I'll clean your house, whatever you need, just, you know, help me make some money. And Garcia from 16th and Emerson with Garcia's Hot Dogs, he private messaged me and he said, amiga, make tamales. And I said, well, that's hilarious because number one, like I said, he is Mexican and he's telling a white girl to make tamales. That's funny. That was just, I feel like that was God just laughing and saying, go ahead and try this. And I did. And I put it on Facebook, and within 1 hour, I had 200 tamales sold, and I had to cut it off, and I was hyperventilating because I could barely sell 150 between me and my friend every year for 6 years prior to that. So it just took off. I mean, it just was just the right time. And that's why I say it was an accidental business. I did not know 200 tamales were about to be ordered in 1 hour.
Now, that's just nuts. So you put it out on Facebook, you know, or and that's what it took?
Yes, that was all it took. Use your Facebook, guys. If you want to build a business, use Facebook. It's awesome.
How did that go, you know, in starting a business? You know, was it hard? Was it challenging?
There's always been a burning desire in me and I knew I was an entrepreneur. So there's always been a burning desire to have a business, but I didn't know it would start so quickly. So I'm a mother of four, and I was just used to being at home, cleaning, cooking, whatever. But this is actually really fun, this business concept and all of the ventures that I've been going through to figure out how to do it is awesome.
Now, tell me about how you very first got it started, because that's kind of inspired what you're doing now, right?
Yeah. So, how I very first got started, well, I just walked into the business community not knowing a daggone thing and running into walls and trying to figure out what I was doing, feeling my way through, walking around blindly, and some amazing people have helped me out through the way.
So did you hit some snags or some difficulties that you had to navigate through?
Yeah. Well, you know, paying people too much when you don't know that you can do it for free or that there's resources out there to help you.
Well, you know, like, you know, small business resources, that sort of thing.
Yeah, definitely. There's small business resources like SCORE and BOI. Those are some huge helpers to me right now. And actually, I've started on my second venture, which connects to La Mexi Gringa, the kitchen that I'm working out of. I have now turned into a community kitchen.
Well, now tell me about that, because that's very interesting. We have so many food entrepreneurs these days, and they do need space to work, right?
So now my heart is so excited about this, because now I can help the people that are just like I was, coming out of their home, knowing that they have, first of all, a great product, second of all, a passion for culinary, the culinary, you know, world or industry, and And now, I mean, I have a lot of answers now, so I can share them with people. It's so cool. And then I have this facility that I was blessed with by my stepdad. And
well, now, tell me how that came about, how you came to have your community kitchen and what it's called and where it is.
So the community kitchen came about by, it was me and my stepdad, Chef Dan, who we would work out of here together. It was his catering kitchen, and now he has moved into a restaurant in Irvington, and he allowed me to take over this space and turn it into the community kitchen.
It's on East Washington Street, right? And in a part of town where people, there's probably a lot of, not a lot of resources for this sort of thing, and so I think it's probably going to hit an untapped market. So have you had a lot of interest so far?
I have definitely had a lot of interviews that I was able to find a lot of different people that are looking for this on this side of town, on the east side of town, in the Irvington-ish area, close to the south side.
Well, tell me the kind of tamales that you make, the different kinds.
Well, we play around with flavors during the fall months. We do a lot of sweets like pumpkin spice and apple pie. I've done peach cobbler. But the traditional tamales that I make are pork with green salsa, chicken with red or green salsa. I do some bean and cheese. I do some rajas, which are veggies with some spicy peppers and cheese. Yeah.
It's great. So the neighborhood is, you know, has embraced the business, right?
The neighborhood has embraced the business, and actually it's expanded all the way out to, I think a guy came from Geist for the holidays and bought 40 tamales from me. So they're just not easy to find in Indiana, actually. You got to know where to go to find a tamale, and I think my tamales are pretty decent, but if you ever see a little old Mexican lady sitting in a parking lot selling out of the trunk of her car, you should buy from her because they're probably way better.
Now, walk me through the basic ingredients of a tamale. What do you have here?
Okay, so the basic construction of a tamale would be you'd have your masa, you'd have your...
And explain, the masa is...
Masa is a corn dough that you are going to put in a corn husk, and you'll steam it for a Mexican tamale. And then you will, so before you do all that, you'll take your masa, and you'll scoop it out and put it into a corn husk and flatten it out just a little bit, and then you will take some filling of your choice. I have beans right here. Beans and cheese is what one of the tamales that I do. If you have chicken or meat, you would take your chicken and you would put salsa on top. So you put that inside of your masa and you'll just fold it over inside of the corn husk and roll it up, which I can show you how to do during class. And then you'll put it in a special tamale steaming pot and they'll steam.
Steam for about 20 to 30 minutes.
And that's it?
Well, that's kind of it. That's the construction of a tamale, and that's what you'll learn in Basic Tamale 101. Yeah.
So, but now for the classes, you've got all these things prepared for everyone, right? So they do the putting together, right?
Yes, I will show them how to make the masa so that they can go home and make masa and put whatever they want inside of it. And then the rest of it's just like a really fun cooking show. Everything's prepped for them and ready so they can put their own tamales together with no hassle and have fun.
We've been talking with entrepreneur Rita Franco of La Mexi Gringa and The Flippin' Kitchen. For more information, look for La Mexi Gringa and The Flippin' Kitchen on Facebook.
Eat Drink Indiana Radio is made possible with support from Eskenazi Health, providing care to nearly 1 million outpatient visitors each year with the mission to advocate, care, teach, and serve at its hospital and inpatient facility and 11 community health centers located throughout Indianapolis. EskenaziHealth.edu.
Well, we are all about local food here on Eat Drink Indiana Radio, and local food means local bees. And happily, there's a growing interest in beekeeping in Indianapolis. You can check out the beepublic.com website, but to find out how a local beekeeping business gets started,
I talked with Kent Allison of Two Bears Honey recently about how the business got going, what happens during a tough winter, and what happens when a swarm of bees finds you.
Well, my partner and I, 2 years ago, or actually more than 2 years ago, he introduced me actually to bees, and I never thought, you know, as much as I do of them now because of all the medicinal properties that they have. I found out that they're actually a little community, and they have such an intricate part of the ecosystem that I didn't even realize. And he had been bringing up bees with his kids for years, and when he moved in here, he wanted his kids to have bees that they could be involved in, and that's where he introduced it to me.
So what'd you think about them at first?
I stayed my distance. I was like most people where I thought, you know, keep away, they're bound to sting you, they'll swarm all over you. And that certainly wasn't the case. What I found was that they're curious creatures. They came out, the first bees that we had, when they didn't know where they exactly were, they had a new home, a new hive. They come out, and then they explore. And the first bees that came up to me, they do these figure eights. They fly in front of you in figure eights, and they do the same thing in front of their hive. And all they're doing there is they're imaging, and they're imprinting who you are, what you are. Are you a threat? Are you not? What's my home look like? Just really interesting creatures, and I can't get enough of them now. They're like my family pet.
Oh, that's very interesting. So, how did it expand? How did the first year go?
Well, our first year and a half, 2 years. Our very first year, we bought our own bees and our hive, and we didn't expect to harvest because they needed to build up their own honey and storage, and which they did. That winter was tough for them, and they actually died in April. That was our first batch. And we thought, well, we'll get some more bees. And in March, that was March, in April, we noticed a couple of scouts that came to the hive. And we thought, well, they're just looking for what's inside there. They'll rob the honey and take it back to wherever they live. And it was an hour later, our backyard was just covered. It was black in bees.
You got a swarm found you?
A swarm found us, and then they turned our hive into their own home. And threw out all the dead bees, cleaned house. They made the hive, which was looking a little unkept, and they made it look like their own home and cleaned it up.
Oh, that's fascinating. How long did that take? You said you looked out and you saw them. What happened next?
It was that morning we saw a couple of scouts, and within an hour or two we had the swarm, and that lasted maybe about an hour, if that, and they had moved in. And over the next couple of days they had cleaned house, moved out all the dead bees, and named that hive their own.
That's wonderful. So, because I know a lot of times, you know, when the bees die, and it's kind of hard, you know, to get them get a new colony established. So that's kind of neat that they just found you.
It was, and the kids were here for that, and they absolutely loved it, and seeing how that happened, and they actually produced a lot more honey than the ones that we had purchased. We had purchased Italian bees, and we think what's out there is Russian bees. They're a little hardier. And they produced, out of the one hive that we have with three supers we had on top, 75 pounds in their first year. So the swarm worked out best.
Well, those are like tough bees, you know, tough and high-producing bees. So what did you do then? What happened next?
Well, we realized we had a little colony of little worker bees out there, so we lovingly called them the girls. And the thousands of girls that work for us, they made their nest. They also produce 75 pounds of honey. We invited our neighbors, family, friends. We had a number of people in late August that came over for the uncapping of all the frames and the harvesting of the honey. And it was an afternoon of fun. We videotaped the entire process of how it happens, because a lot of people, like I did, are afraid of bees, and they don't know, are they going to sting me, are they going to hurt, you know, I need to keep my distance. And what they found through those videos is they're interesting creatures that have no interest in really what you're doing, as long as you're not harming them, they're there to protect their honey and to thrive off of that. So it was an interesting learning experience for everybody who was involved.
So now how do you go about getting the honey, you know, with the bees there, if they're going to protect their honey, you know, how do you go about harvesting that?
We use it was a board where you put on a vapor, and that vapor, the bees don't like it. So as we put the board on the top super, it shoved all the bees, or the bees went into the next super, and we were able to harvest the very first super, and then we vacuum the rest of the bees, or we blow out the bees, and then we take it into an obscure location where they can't follow us.
So now that super, that is the levels of the beehive, is that right?
Mm-hmm. The first two are usually about a foot deep, and that is their brood and their own honey. So they got their brood, and then they have their own storage for the winter. And then anything above that, the smaller supers, is what you harvest. When our family and friends knew that we were harvesting our own honey, we sent out on our own personal Facebook pages, and it was spoken for before we even had it out of the frames. So it went very, very well. And after we went through all of that, we had people still asking for honey. And we didn't have any of our own to sell. But they still wanted local honey because they understood the medicinal properties and all the goodness that comes from the properties of honey. And so we looked around and found local beekeepers who produce mass or have mass quantities of our own local Indianapolis honey, and we bottle it under our name. In these jars that we produce, they're in Muth jars is what they're called. It's a very 1800s jar that was produced by a gentleman who wanted to be able to provide his honey with the best looking packaging that he could provide back then, and we're still using that same jar that he produced. We have a 1 pound Muth jar, we have a half pound and a quarter pound. We offer it in clover and also in wildflower, and we are now expanding into facial scrubs as well and other medicinal products. And then on our company Facebook page, which is Two Bears Honey, we offer daily tidbits about bees so people can learn about them, and then we also do a daily recipe that involves local honey.
Oh, now tell me how people can get a hold of the local honey.
The local honey is available either by looking at our Facebook page and going to shop through Facebook, or then go directly to our web page at www.twobearshoney.com.
If someone were going to keep bees, how do they actually get the bees if they're not lucky enough to have a swarm come find them?
Well, you can find local beekeepers who can provide you with your own nucleus of bees and your own hive, because you can buy the hive in a complete kit, including the bees. Which is about 325. But if you want to buy your own bees, you have your own hive, or you want to expand the bees, you can buy them over the internet, Kelly Bees, and they come to United States Parcel Post, and you get a call, says your box is here, and it's buzzing.
We've been talking with Kent Allison, who operates Two Bears Honey with partner Scott Tyler. For information, updates, and recipes, find Two Bears on Facebook or go to twobearshoney.com. Well, the Indianapolis food scene has so many creative entrepreneurs, and Erin Eds has been one of the most successful. You probably know her from Who's Your Mama, the Bloody Mary mix that she co-founded. But Erin also launched Country Mouse City Mouse with her sister Katie and sold those products through local stores and farmers markets. Erin also teaches in the culinary program at Ivy Tech Community College, and now she's working on a new business called Dark Horse Delicatessen that will bring a lot of these interests together. I talked to Erin recently about Dark Horse Deli, its concept, and what we can expect from her new business.
We are really excited to be moving on to some great new projects. Had a great 4-year run with Who's Your Mama, and I'm excited about the future. So the most exciting thing and the most current development is Dark Horse Delicatessen, which is going to be a vegetarian and vegan deli, cafe, market, and catering
tell me a little bit about the concept and how it's going to work?
Yeah, I'm really excited about it. The funny thing is, as I tend to do in life, I put the cart way before the horse and started promoting a concept that I hadn't fully fleshed out before we even really knew what we were doing, and started getting some really nice buzz around it. And as my darling husband Steven said, is, well, now you've done it.
But it's a thing now, right?
Yeah, it's absolutely a thing now. Still very much in its infancy, but Dark Horse is going to be a learning kitchen, as well as an educational opportunity. I'm working with some people, some different groups right now to form strategic partnerships. But the goal is to provide amazing food, phenomenal customer service, awesome retail, and employ culinary students while they are in school, provide them a fair wage and opportunities to learn about how to run and start a business. It will have several facets. One of the things I'm most excited about is bringing back the Country Mouse City Mouse retail line.
Oh, now tell me all about that.
Right. So some of you may remember Country Mouse City Mouse. We started it in 2008, my sister and I, and it was a very popular brand for about 3 years. And
now this was at the farmers markets, right?
Farmers markets, green bean delivery, Whole Foods, Good Earth. So we had a nice reach with that. I would love to bring those products back, branded under Dark Horse, and start reintroducing those back into the wholesale market to create a second revenue source for the foundation that this will be.
So culinary students would be working in this and learning how to do it and what all of this takes?
Exactly. I mean, so much of what we learned in the first few years of doing Country Mouse are things that I would love to help people achieve without the blood, sweat, and tears of figuring it out for themselves. So if there's a way that I can take what I've learned and pass it on to the new generation of artisan food producers, then that would just mean the world to me.
Now tell me a little bit about those days when you were doing Country Mouse City Mouse with some of the products and you know, the excitement that you felt then.
You know, it's really funny. We look back and we realize we were very much at the beginning of this entire wave of individual small companies putting their products into the market, especially in Indianapolis. At the time that we started Country Mouse City Mouse, we were one of the only value-add booths at any of the markets we participated in outside of like bread and baked goods. You know, we were making a line of accessory items, condiments, salad dressings, compound butters, you know, packaged in an interesting way and made with, you know, great ingredients. We were also at the very beginning of the gluten-free movement. All of our products were gluten-free, with very little exception. And it was great because that niche was really just starting to get a foothold and people were looking for new and interesting products.
Now tell me when that was and how you started to do that.
It was in 2008, and my sister and I always joked that we would love to be in business together, and the Country Mouse City Mouse name came about when Katie was going to college in Chicago and I was living in Western Washington. So we always said we were the Country Mouse and the City Mouse. Now we're both, you know, living in Broad Ripple and, you know, we're near North Side Mice, but you know, at the time it was so fitting to our personalities and, you know, our sort of view of the world.
Now, what was it like? Because, you know, it seems like everyone has an idea. Everyone has a food idea. They're gonna launch a business or something like that. What was it like starting that then?
It took a lot of kind of customer education as well as education on the part of groups like the Marion County Health Department. We were one of the first companies that was licensed to work out of a kitchen that we didn't necessarily own. You know, The kitchen we worked out of had the ability to be Board of Health certified, but we had to individually get our own certification. So, you know, they had to learn how to navigate that. The market managers had to figure out how we fit in. And then we had to really, you know, kind of get our customers on board with what we were doing. And it was pretty easy because what we were pushing out was pretty fabulous.
You had some very, very good stuff and very popular items. So are those some things you mentioned bringing some of those back? Those are the things that we could expect maybe to see again?
Yeah, absolutely. A lot of our recipes were based on family traditional recipes that either my mother had conceived of or had been kind of in the family repertoire for years. We definitely would be bringing back the Romesco, the Jezebel. I think the compound butters, again, would be phenomenal. Those little push-up containers that they were in are now actually pretty readily available. I spent months sourcing that packaging, and now you can buy them online for 10 cents a piece.
I know, and I remember those. I remember the Butter Boy and the Butter Girl packaging, and it was like, oh my God, how cool is this? Because it was just so, you know, it was so neat, something that you had found, you know. And so I remember those, and so it's those kind of ideas, I think, that people can expect you to bring to this new kind of project. So now tell me how then some of these products will fit in to the new concept, the Dark Horse Deli concept.
Yeah, so with Dark Horse being a, you know, quote-unquote vegetarian deli, it's kind of a contradiction in terms. You know, people have said, how do you have a vegetarian deli? Well, you know, a lot of what you see in delis are bulk items, you know, big bowls of salads and soups and, you know, items that you can buy in bulk to take home or also order, you know, at the counter. It'll be counter service and, you know, sit down and have a great lunch or, you know, early dinner.
So the concept then is, you know, tell me again a little bit about how it fits together, the different components and how it's all going to come together for one concept.
Yeah, so we will be working out of one kitchen with one of my strategic partners. We will hopefully be doing some college curriculum out of the kitchen in entrepreneurship as well as business management. And it will, you know, it'll just give us an opportunity to showcase. And I kind of digress. One of the things that my husband often said to me when I was doing Country Mouse, City Mouse, as well as Who's Your Mama, was that I was constantly giving other people credit. And, you know, you look back at some of my indie style appearances, for instance, and I always had other companies as the focus. You know, here we're making this cocktail, but you know, here's the vodka that I'm using, or who, you know, here's the gin, and that's who makes, you know, here's who makes it, and you know, always giving other people, you know, raising other people up around me, because if it was good for them, it was good for our community, and therefore, you know, it was good for me by proxy. And so this is going to give us an opportunity to really showcase those other brands as well. The space will have a heavy retail component where we will sell local and regional craft food items as well as gift items.
So this is we're talking a brick and mortar location, as well as any, you know, online component too, or, you know, what are you seeing?
Actually, my hope, not so much to have an online store, but Green Bean Delivery was one of our absolute best accounts when we were fully up and running with Country Mouse, and it would mean the world to me to be back on their website, have the Dark Horse products available on their website, you know, with a note on there that says proceeds from the sale of this product will go to provide culinary education for, you know, people that are wanting that.
So now tell me about a little bit about your ideas on the importance of learning this kind of stuff. When someone is a student or when someone is just trying to get that idea going.
Yeah, having the idea, honestly, is the hardest part. You know, having something that you can prove the viability of is very important. So for this to be a test market for them, you know, for the students that are looking to grow an existing business or start an artisan food company from scratch, there's not a lot of education out there that is specific to a wholesale line. So hopefully, you know, we'd be able to provide some guidance in that department while giving them an opportunity to make and sell their products through us to see if people would like to buy it.
So now, is there can people find some more information about this or follow your progress somewhere?
Yeah, part of what we did as far as putting the cart before the horse is setting up Facebook and Twitter pages. You know, coming soon, Dark Horse Delicatessen, which has probably gotten me in some trouble, but that's okay. Twitter is at Dark Horse Deli, and Facebook is the same, facebook.com/Dark Horse Deli.
Do you have a time frame on when we can look for progress?
Well, because this is going to be operating as essentially a nonprofit, the biggest factor right now is finding the people or the organizations to underwrite it. You know, I have to find the financial backing in order to be able to even start looking for a space. Last thing I want is to fall in love with a place and then lose it because I didn't have the backing at that time. So, you know, as soon as I have the right partners in place, I'll be ready to roll.
We've been talking with Erin Eds about her new Dark Horse Delicatessen business. For more information, look for Dark Horse Deli on Twitter and Facebook. You've been listening to Eat Drink Indiana Radio on WFYI HD To The Point. I'm your host, Jolene Katzenberger. Thanks for tuning in today to hear from some of our local food entrepreneurs. Mel McMahon of Indiana Originals, Kate Drury of The Flying Cupcake and The Dancing Donut, Rita Franco of La Mexigringa and The Flippin' Kitchen, Kent Allison of Two Bears Honey, and Erin Eds of Dark Horse Delicatessen. And thanks to producer John Katzenberger for helping to bring you Eat Drink Indiana Radio.